Thank you. Now, someone is here from cognitive psychology and neuropsychology, right? Mike, is Anna here now?
He's at the university.
Yeah. Does anybody know what he does? It's a joke. But he's here.
He's away this week.
Yeah, okay. Do you have a pointer?
There's a wooden pointer, and here's a pointer.
It's usually run on the table.
Oh, is there?
The wooden pointer is always my favorite because I know how to use those.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a green one. I love green.
Okay, right.
So I'll just start to talk and interrupt, ask me questions, whatever. The talk has something to do with my T-shirt that I have on, and some of you will know the name Von Economo, but most won't. But for those people in neuroscience, almost everybody knows the name Brodmann. And Brodmann talked about cortical areas, and for Brodmann, the concept of a cortical area was that each area was an organ of the brain, like the heart is different from the kidney and so on. Each subdivision that would do something different in harmony with the other subdivisions to allow cognitive and other mental abilities. If we say area 17, that's Brodmann's number, and Brodmann's numbers are used rather extensively. But Von Economo had another series, and he used area CA or some different letters like that, and they would stand for maybe occipital letter region A, B, and C. And so this is the only other system that's really used, and both of these systems are highly flawed, and they're flawed in the sense that they used perceived histological differences in different regions of cortex to divide up the brain into a number of areas. So they got different results. And everybody that used these methods 100 years ago got different results. But they got approximations. So I want to talk to you largely about the numbers of areas that are the number of organs that we have in neocortex, subdivisions of neocortex, how many are there, what are they, and so on, and how do they vary across species, and what happened from early mammals to present-day humans in terms of evolution. Now, if I can find the pointers here, the advance.
Space.
Okay. I love this picture because this chimpanzee had just had its diaper changed, so my shirt didn't get wet. We have a lot of interest in human brains and chimpanzee brains. Most of what we use to think about how the human brain is organized actually comes from experimental data that comes from monkeys. And we've gathered this largely from macaque monkeys over a period of time. And this is a classical summary diagram of the visual system for a macaque monkey, but the implication is that the human visual system must be something like this, only a bit more complicated. And the way of doing this, since the cortex is a sheet, is to strip this sheet away, make some cuts in it so you can flatten it out, and then put names on different parts. And this is Fellman and Van Essen. We've already heard about Van Essen earlier today in regard to fissures. And Fellman was a graduate student that went on to do with me, that did a postdoc with Van Essen. But the point was is that this is just looking at the visual areas. There are a lot of visual areas. They take up a lot of the brain, a lot of the cortex. And of course, there are somatosensory, auditory, and other divisions and so on. But here are the proposed visual areas. That's part of the story. The other part of the story, and this took a lot of work, and looking and summarizing a vast amount of data that had been collected about this time, 1991, and said, how do these areas connect with one another, and is there some sort of processing hierarchy that we can assume? And the processing hierarchy was based on directness of connections and also a concept that's called feed forward and feedback, two different kinds of connections. And you can build, you can have areas be at about the same level of processing or higher levels. And these would be subthalamus into the, or subcortex, and then you would get early on down here, and then you would get into cortical areas and so on. And this is the scheme they came up with. You can see it's really very complex. And there are about 35 visual areas. Now, if you ask visual neuroscientists that study the cortex, they will agree that this is about the level of complexity that would exist in a macaque monkey. And they would also largely agree that the complexity has to be even greater in a human brain, but they wouldn't agree on the details of this. And in fact, it's not widely appreciated, but Van Essen and Fellman said out of these 35 areas that they propose in here, only five are well defined. They rank areas in terms of how well they were defined and how well they were really understood by a scale of 1 to 3, and only 5 got a score of 1, and 2 of those I disagree with. But this is the order of complexity that exists in old world monkey visual cortex, not even counting really the complexity that's at the subcortical level.
Sean.
Yeah.
What fraction of projections are how many more projections that were not known at the time are missing from this?
Well, you probably know a lot more about this than I do even. But the general rule is that these would be the major projections because they're the most obvious if you do a study, and the major connections are going to be with about 3 areas. You know, V1 would be about 80% with one area, V2. So there are going to be major projections with a few areas, but if you go down to 1% of the connections and those things, then each area would maybe connect with 10 others. And this wiring...
It's just the big major pathways.
So this is the major pathways, and they're the ones that were that are feed-forward.
Because I was just amusing myself trying to find V1 to MT, which is something I've been reading a lot about
lately,
and I can't find it on there.
Well, V1 is here, and it's circling around, and it's a big one, but it's still... less than 10% of the output.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's an important connection, but it's about 10%,
right.
Less than 10% of the output. Now, I should say, and you reminded me of a joke, and the joke is that a drug company came out with this diagram, but they changed one area. And he entered a contest out of that. Could you find the area that had been changed? And the title was, Find the Nonsense Area. And I was thinking, there are so many of them. Because our state of knowledge about most of this is so weak that they're proposed subdivisions, and another person would propose something else, just like Brodmann and von Economo proposed different things. But they both agreed that a human brain has a lot of subdivisions. We're better off than this because some of these are very solid, and some of the ones that weren't solid at this time are much more solid now. But I just want to give you an idea of the problem, the magnitude of the problem. Here's one I did for the somatosensory system. It's really incomplete. I gave up because I got tired of doing it and I couldn't get a graduate student to do it. But it's the same sort of thing. You have peripheral processing, thalamic processing, early cortical processing, other kinds of cortical processing, and so on into the motor system. And so you have a lot of areas, not as many as in the visual system, but this is for a macaque monkey again. A lot of subdivisions interconnecting and forming some kind of system with levels. And here's one I did a few years ago with my coworker Troy Hackett. And the auditory system has a lot of complexity at the subcortical level and at the thalamic level. But then you have cortical processing, a whole lot of areas, very much like these other regions. And some of these are well-defined, some of them are more hypothetical or not so well-defined, but this gives you an idea that all of these systems are similar in that they have levels, a lot of areas involved, and they're interconnected in a hierarchical manner. And you could do this for... Now, this is just give you a feeling or the reality of some of the things. This is cortex that's flat, artificially flattened, so you can cut it parallel to the surface so you can see what happens across the surface. The reason that there are cracks in this is it's hard to flatten a brain after you get some fixative in it. But it shows that you can, with different stains, this is for parvobumin, a calcium modulating protein, but it shows that there's a dark area in here, and we know from physiological recordings and other kinds of evidence it's divided into three auditory areas that operate more or less in parallel. So there's a lot of parallel processing in the auditory system, and these are primary or primary-like areas surrounded by other areas that we've named here that aren't so well defined, and then further areas out here and so on. But you can see that histologically, there are subdivisions of the brain that you can identify and really draw a line around that aren't in disagreement, that there isn't much controversy over. Now, my interest was in evolution of a human brain and the complexity of the human brain, and we were looking at old world monkeys here, but this is a phylogenetic scheme of times of divergence into the past, millions of years ago, and the array of present-day primates, a lot of prosimians, then anthropoid simians. These are the ones that are related to us, the great apes, and then humans. And so to understand the evolution of the brain, where you want to go back into time and start looking using information from comparative studies to guess what early primates would be like, or even early mammals might have been like. But one of the things that's been alluded to already quite a bit, and we know for sure that primate brains and mammal brains vary a lot in size. So this would be relative sizes. Actually, it's greater than this. This is too large. This is too large. But monkey brains, chimpanzee brains, human brains are much different in size. This is about three times or four times the size of this. But one area was one of the first areas ever described, Area 17 or striate cortex or primary visual cortex, is easy to define because histologically it's so distinct. And we can outline it here. You don't see all of it because it's tucked around in the medial wall. But if you just consider one of those areas that is easy to define and go across some primates or other animals, would just go here. The size of Area 17 doesn't increase. You could get that from the earlier slide. It doesn't increase as fast as the size of the brain increases, or the surface area of cortex increases. And my only point here is that even if we have trouble defining a lot of the cortical areas precisely and identifying them, the fact that as brains get bigger, the easy to define areas in primates I'm talking about here occupy proportionally less and less of the total amount of cortex implies that something else is happening. And what I'd like to propose, and most people would agree that study this issue, is that the number of cortical areas is increasing. The evidence, still a lot needs to be gathered. But if we start with the brains of the first mammals and try to reconstruct what they were like, we would come to the conclusion that instead of Brodmann's 55 areas for the human brain, which is a gross underestimate because it's in the order of 100, between 100 and 150, something like that. That would be a modern estimate. Early mammals only had on the order of 20 to 25 areas of the brain, functionally distinct regions of the cortex. But what we know for sure about early mammals is for the most part, they were small. This is a reconstruction from a skeleton on a finger here. You can see that they're small and has a small head, and a small head implies a small brain. And if you wanted to look at inside at the endocasts of these early mammals, and some of them were preserved well enough so that could be done. You can get an idea of what their brain was like 100 million years ago or 80 million years ago or even longer. And these early mammals not only had small brains all together overall, but this part of the brain, the neocortex, which is the hallmark of the human brain, so expanded and taking up so much volume, was very, very small. And you can tell it's small because there's a little fissure here that separates it from olfactory cortex, a small dimple there. So this is piriform cortex, all olfactory bulbs here. So you can see the olfactory bulbs themselves are dwarf the amount of neocortex. So early mammals emphasized olfactory processing, had very little of this neocortex that we treasure so much.
What is it based on? I mean, the brains are preserved somehow?
The brain isn't preserved, but the skull preserves the shape of the brain. And from the shape, you can see a little ridge along here. It would be a little indentation that would be a fissure. The larger the brain and the more fissures, the more you might be able to see from the imprint, the skull itself. So it's a cast of the inside of the skull. Now, it seems only logical if early mammals had small brains with little neocortex. If you wanted to guess or reconstruct, I guess is a bad word, reconstruct what features of neocortex there were in the brains of early mammals, you wouldn't start with a human brain, or you wouldn't start with an elephant brain. You wouldn't start with mammals with a huge brain, because obviously a lot of things could have happened there. So if you pick mammals with small brains, little neocortex, then what are their brains like? So we started to look at this small mammal, insectivore from Madagascar, that's called a tenrec, because it looks a lot like early mammals seem to look like from their skeletal remains. And when we used experimental methods, histology recording, to study this brain, I just want to show you how big the olfactory bulb is. Olfactory tubercle, piriform cortex, which is all olfactory. The midbrain isn't covered here. Here's the superior colliculus division, inferior colliculus, cerebellum, brainstem. But this is all of the neocortex there is. And we have an auditory region here, a visual region here, somatosensory here, and a motor region here. And there isn't a lot of room left for other things. But those are regions that are easy to identify. And if you just take this brain and flatten it out, this is the roadkill preparation, and flatten it out and cut parallel to the surface, you can see these components. So here's the olfactory bulb. All of this is olfactory down here. Here's the auditory region. Here's the somatosensory region. Here's the motor region here. Here's the visual, primary visual cortex. Here's some cingulate cortex here. We have a corpus callosum, septal region of the brain, and so on down in here. So neocortex is this little part here. It's not as big as this. And this is the hippocampus unfolded there. So you can see the hippocampus is about as almost as big as neocortex.
What's the stain here?
This is a myelin stain.
So the primary sensory areas?
So the primary areas are more myelinated as we crossed all mammals. And so you can, they stand out here. But this is all confirmed by relating microelectrode recordings to these this histology.
Why don't other brain regions need as much myelin?
The primary areas I can show you in later that stand out with a lot of different preparations, but why do they have more myelin? The myelin, as you talked about, probably adds speed. These are large for the amount of cortex that you have. These take up a large portion of the area. So communication within the area, I think, takes lateral connections.
I guess I'm interested in the fact that there seems to be less requirement for, just quantitatively, less requirement for myelin once you get into, you know, these other non-sensory.
Once you get away from that, you don't get much. And some of the older areas, I mean, this is cingulate cortex retrospinal cortex over here. Not much myelin over there. Not much myelin in this endorhinal region. The parts that feed into the hippocampus would be here, and they're not myelinated. So you'd think, well, speed isn't as important.
This is true of bigger brain animals as well.
Absolutely. More
well,
so.
More pretty so. Slow. The receptors are really quite slow. And so well, no. Gases to fusion.
Yeah. So my reason for my last follow-up question is that in a larger brain, you've got longer conduction distances. If it's still true, even in a big brain, there's a differential between primary sensory, non-olfactory primary sensory areas, and let's just call it association cortex.
Yeah, for these primaries, you have fast pathways from the periphery to get to them. Yeah. But then what's looking here is the lateral connections within the area. So you have fast transmission within the area from region to region as well. And vision, because of the photoreception problem, is pretty slow. So the first activation of the visual cortex is quite a bit after the auditory, the somatosensory.
Okay, so those are actually only local connections you're looking at, the white matter.
This isn't cut deep enough to get into the white matter below the cortex, which then there'd be black everywhere. Mm-hmm. Black means myelin.
Oh, so this is in Europa.
This is cutting right through cortex, just above layer 4.
Okay.
The lateral connections are most dense in layer 3.
Right.
So, but I just showed you one example, one animal with a small brain. But this is the phylogeny, the modern view of phylogeny of mammals, starting about 250 million years ago from a kind of, I would say, reptile. It's unpopular to call them reptiles now. George knows about that. So I've changed this, George. It doesn't say reptile. But it would be a reptile in anybody that we saw one. We'd say, that's a reptile. And mammals have branched off into these major clades. Six of them, and the best way of comparing and determining what this mammal might have been like is see what small brain members of all these clades share in common. And the argument would be if they share it in common, it's unlikely, more likely that they inherited it from a common ancestor than that they evolved it independently themselves. That's the logic of the cladistic character analysis paradigm. So it's hard to do these studies because it takes so long to study any particular animal in any detail. But we know about four of the clades, small brain mammals from about four of the clades fairly well. And in this clade, which includes primates, rodents, lagomorphs, and so on, the mouse might be the smallest. This happens to be a rat. But we can see that in opossums, marsupial opossums, you have these visual areas, these somatosensory areas, auditory and so on. No motor cortex, no distinct motor cortex. This is a hedgehog, which is a different group than the tenrec completely. And we see the areas, primary visual cortex, auditory cortex, this collection of somatosensory areas. A motor area up here. This is the tenrec, which has a motor area and the same set of connections or collection of areas, and then a rat. And these are all four different clades, or four different major groups that diverged 80 to 135 million years ago. And you see these basic areas taking up most of the cortex in all of these animals. If you wanted to add other areas that are going to be there, you're going to have cingulate cortex, you're going to have retrosplenial cortex, you're going to have a few more. And these are harder to demonstrate physiologically, but not anatomically. And so we can conclude from this that early mammals not only didn't have many areas, but they had rather simple processing systems. Here would be basically it for an early mammal: a primary somatosensory area, some processing in the brainstem, in the thalamus, some pathways that we recognize in all mammals, fringe areas on each side that further process somatosensory areas, a couple secondary areas, and by then you're getting into memory systems. Or you're getting into other kinds of systems, motor systems that would deal with directly from this area, for example, that would deal with behavior. So fairly simple in terms of number of parts. And so we conclude in order of 100 million years ago, mammals had small brains, proportionally little neocortex compared to olfactory cortex, few cortical areas, 20 to 25, and histologically they weren't well differentiated. And the differentiation that if areas are well differentiated histologically, it implies that their functions are more distinct, and if the layers are histologically more differentiated, it implies that the layers, the six layers of cortex, are more distinct in what they're doing. And so poor differentiation suggests that all of the areas processed in a somewhat similar manner, and the specialized roles of the cortical layers weren't as separate as they can be. Now if we go and look at our step to primates, here's some of the placental mammals, the four major radiations of placental mammals, and we won't consider these other ones anymore, but we'll just consider the line that gave rise to primates. And out of that, I told you before, we have this branch here that gave rise to lagomorphs and rodents, so it's sort of humiliating to think how closely we are related to rats and mice. And then we have this other branch that gave rise to tree shrews and flying lemurs, which don't fly and aren't lemurs. But that's a common name for them. And then primates, which include the prosimian primates.
Tree shrews aren't shrews.
And the tree shrews aren't shrews. And they don't live in trees. But tree shrews resemble primates in a number of ways, so much that an early investigator, Legros-Clark, classified them for a long time as a primate, argued that they deserve to be in the primate order. The relationship isn't so close that you would do that, and that's not done anymore. They're put in their own order. But it pays to look at their brain when you want to think of how the primate brain might have evolved from other mammals that would be related, for example, in the same superorder, or the main group, rats and lagomorphs, rodents and lagomorphs. And this is a tree shrew and what it looks like. And you can see from its eye that it's large, visual, but it looks like a squirrel or something like that. You wouldn't be overly impressed, and you wouldn't call this right off a primate from its hand use or any of the other features. What's interesting from the brain is it has a large occipital region that covers the midbrain completely, and a large temporal region, not much in the frontal cortex at all. And what you would guess from that, from comparative studies, temporal cortex, the large temporal cortex is either going to be auditory or it's going to be visual, and the large occipital region is going to be visual. So you can say this animal must emphasize vision a lot. And so this is just get back to the issue of cladistic comparisons. The brains of all living mammals contain a mixture, this is the premise, of features that can be identified as primitive or derived in the context of a cladistic analysis. So similarities often reflect a relationship, that is a genetic relationship or a phylogenetic relationship, and that's what we're at here. This is some conclusions about the organization of a tree shrew brain that came about from a lot of studies. And just as you might, there's a reasonably good olfactory system here, as you can see. This is the neocortex here. Primary visual cortex is huge. Secondary visual cortex here. There are a number of other visual areas. This is all visual, but we don't know how it's subdivided. Auditory is here, and it has several subdivisions. Somatosensory is here, and it has adjacent somatosensory areas and two lateral somatosensory areas over here that are secondary. Primary motor cortex is here, so it's subdivided, but I won't go into that. And then there's a secondary motor area that's right up in this location that hasn't been fully worked out. And the reason the colors are here is that this represents forelimb, and forelimb is represented a lot in this brain, unlike most mammals. Not compared to the face and mouth, which have huge representations in most mammals. And hindlimb would be up in this region and so on. But these colors indicate that there's a posterior parietal region that projects into these regions that has these forelimb or face functions or mixed functions, and that some of this visual cortex back here also has connections with motor cortex that indicate that it would be related to parts of motor cortex representing the forelimb or representing the face and forelimb. So this is evidence of something that is much more elaborate in primates, but a posterior parietal, this is parietal cortex here, and this is the posterior part of parietal cortex and a visual parietal region here, where there's good signs of a system that would be for visual control of motor behavior in tree shoes, and the closest relative of primates that we've been able to study. The only other one that's perhaps a tad closer would be the flying lemur, which is quite specialized for gliding. Now, I just wanted to show you that if you cut through this cortex, just to show you what it looks like, here's the myelin picture that you would get in primary visual cortex. And you can see there's a dense band of myelinization that's in layer 3. This is layer 4, not so much myelination within of connections within layer 4. And then just below that in layer 5, there's another dense band of connections. So you can use that to identify this region rather clearly. A different pattern appears here in the second area. This is cytochrome oxidase, which is a metabolic marker. So it gives you an idea where neurons are the most active. And they're going to be most active in layer 4 because that's where the drive will come. So those neurons presumably are more active because they express more cytochrome oxidase. This is expression of zinc, and I'll only say that white means there's not much zinc there, not much synaptic zinc, and that means that some from the thalamus, because the projections from the thalamus don't use synaptic zinc. The ones from cortex do use synaptic zinc. Why, I'm not sure, but it's a marker for regions with a lot of thalamic inputs, sort of leached out here. And this is a transporter for glutamate, and this transporter is used in connections that come from the thalamus. And so we expect to see a lot of that in layer 4, and that's exactly where you see it. You also see a little bit in layer 3 here, which indicates that the thalamus is also projecting lightly to layer 3. So I'm just showing you, and this is a standard Nissl stain, which everybody uses. So I'm just showing you some of the features.
So layer 4 in area 17 has lots of, does this imply that it's going to be very active and receive? Is it the place of highest firing rates in visual cortex?
Oh, it should be the highest firing rate. The cytochrome oxidase certainly supports that conclusion. And it also gets direct inputs from the thalamus. These other preparations show that. And the activation should be rather local. The main connections of layer 4 neurons are vertical, not horizontal. So you don't have myelin systems to transport information laterally within the area from there. But all these just show you that at least some areas, all of us in the room would be able to identify the border and with a lot of confidence. This just shows some of those things at higher power. And you can see how the layers are well differentiated. Part of my point here is that in tree shoes, and when you get into considering primates, you're going to see a lot of well-differentiated areas in terms of areas differing from one another in their appearance and layers being much more distinct than you would have in early mammals. So these are specializations that occur in this line, but not all lines, and not in early mammals, but these rather distinct differences in appearance in these different preparations. But they also give you some confidence that you're judging things correctly when you're making your borders. Yes?
When the 6 layers appear in evolution?
So there's a convention starting with Brodmann of numbering layers 1 through 6, but early on people used other, could have 7, could have 8 different numbers. And if I went back and I showed you those layers, you could say, well, I see more layers than 6. And so by convention, we call those sublayers. So we have the main 6 layers, and then we call sublayers if they're visible. But you could argue that for another number. If you compare with current reptiles, you get a quite different picture, and George Strider here is an expert on that, a quite different picture of dorsal cortex organization, which is a homologue of neocortex in mammals, and it has a much different organization. Basically, if I is that you have a layer of pyramidal cells and other cells, and you have inputs coming to the dendrites above that and an output. And so it's very simple and thin by comparison to neocortex. And that's one of the arguments that neocortex is new with mammals. But now we propose that it's not new with mammals, it's just that the thickening and differentiation into a number of layers is new with mammals.
But what I was asking, do you see intermediate step? I mean, like
there's no intermediate step. All of the ancestors going back to how many million, 350 million or something, on the line to present-day mammals are extinct, and they're gone, so you can't get anything from it. So the nearest comparison would be present-day reptiles. And that point of divergence is really ancient. So we don't have intermediates. So, and so
but small animals,
it makes it wide open for theorists.
So another way to ask the question is, do small-brained mammals seem to have about as much layer complexity as large-brained mammals?
They don't have the clear differentiation into sublayers. Usually you can identify the main layers. You can identify 6, 5, 4, and 3, 2. One is just the fibers on the top main layer.
Does that mean that circuits, certain local intracolumnar circuits in a large-brained mammal might be more complex than a small brain mammal?
It suggests that within layer 3, for example, that you'll have sublayers with more distinct functions, be less uniform in what's happening. Mm-hmm. Same with layer 4 having sublayers, or layer 5 having sublayers, or layer 6 having sublayers. More for your money. And the analogous situation would be in birds and reptiles, where the superior colliculus optictectum is more laminated in some species, or more clearly laminated in some species than other. And this is getting more isolation, if you like, I think, of neuron types and more specialized neuron types to do subroutines within a sort of a columnar organization. Okay, this is a surface view of cortex in the tree shoe. And you can see it's been technically altered, and it doesn't look like cortex. But the point here is that one of the features of cortex, are we pushing here? Do I need to wrap up?
I'm just a little bit worried for Susanna's sake. I feel bad rushing you, but we do have to. So whatever we do, we're stopping at 15, so maybe you can keep on going. I guess. Can we have her talk after? I apologize. You can see, like, I'm the guy.
But I'll be done. There will be no cookies in this because of me. our relatives, rodents and lagomorphs, don't have a kind of organization in visual cortex that all primates have and tree shoes share. So I just wanted to make the point that tree shoes are the closest animal to primates that we've been able to study experimentally, and they share a lot of features with us. And one is that cortex is organized in terms of columns or groups of cells for, sensitive to specific orientations of stimuli. The orientation columns exist here in tree shoes. They exist in all primates, and they don't exist in any rodent or any lagomorph.
You know, rodents have a different way of interacting with the environment. They have this research that is going around, and they have a different way of detecting.
Rodents do, but squirrels are extremely visual animals. They have a beautiful visual system, very large visual cortex, but they don't have ocular dominance of columns. I mean, they don't have orientation columns. So it's characteristic, whether you're visual or not, for rodents that they don't have, and it's characteristic of all primates, even the nocturnal ones, have the orientation columns, and our closest relatives also have these. So they popped in there sometime before tree shoes and primate lines diverged. But after the divergence from rodents and lagomorphs. So that's the sort of a conclusion you would come from that.
And the flying, what were they?
What? The size of these?
You have this other group.
Oh, this is a study of connections, and black means connections.
But you had this flying lemurs.
Oh, flying lemurs.
Yeah.
Okay, you can't get those. You know, they're endangered, so you couldn't study them. But if you could, I bet, you know. I give good odds that they do, you know.
Are there primates with brains smaller than that of a tree shrew?
The mouse lemur, Microcebus, is the smallest one, and it's about the size of the tree shrew brain.
So it's still larger than a rodent brain, larger than a rat brain. Sorry.
It's larger than a rat brain, although the Microcebus is smaller than a rat, but it has the larger brain.
The reason for my question is, yeah. I'm wondering what the smallest brain is that people have seen the orientation columns in the primate and, you know, kind of at a primate line.
Well, they haven't seen them in Microcebus because you can't study them. They're protected. They're endangered. Although they're not endangered.
That's not what I mean by haven't seen. Looked but haven't seen. That's what it does.
And every primate that's been looked has it. And you can do this rather easily with optical imaging. It's beautiful, yeah. So.
You could ask the question the other way, but you've seen them in larger rodents, right?
Yeah.
Capybaras.
Susanna would have to do the capybara, but the largest rodent that's been done is the gray squirrel. And they don't have them.
You can do the nutria, right? Those are common as dirt.
Yeah, so I don't think it's a matter of size. I think it's a matter of different avenues have been taken in different clades, that you have some innovation or not, and it's used then by all members of the clade.
How about ferrets?
Ferrets do, but they're completely different relation. They're in Afrotheria. All carnivores appear to have them, but they've only been looked at in ferrets and domestic cats.
So that's some kind of convergent evolution.
So it's a convergent evolution, absolutely.
I guess you cannot rule out yet that it could just be a matter of having enough neurons and then they start to become organized this way because...
It's true that if you have so few neurons, it doesn't even pay to do anything like this. So Howard Cooper looked at... In one of the mole rats that have a very small striate cortex, skin over their eyes, so all they do is get light intensity and so on. There's no organization to the visual cortex. It can be activated by visual stimuli, but there's no organization to it. But he argued that there's so few neurons that there'd be no point because you couldn't capture the information in an image with that few neurons. So if you got down to a minimum size of striate cortex, if it isn't large enough, there would be no point in having this kind of organization. You couldn't have it.
Yes, my point was that since rats and rodents and primates scale differently, even if you have a rat-sized visual cortex, it's not going to have as many neurons as a similar-sized primate cortex. So you cannot compare size directly. That's not a good proxy for number of neurons. So, could be.
Okay, but the thing is, that's interesting, but the thing that I was trying to get at here is, let's just do it in units of number of neurons then. There seem to be two different ideas here. One is that there's something special about orientation columns that arises in tree shrews and primates, and now we've heard also in carnivores, and you said that they don't arise in rodents, but can we rule out the idea that the species that have been studied have sufficiently different numbers of neurons that, in fact, this has not been, in some sense, studied in a cladistic sense?
One of the things that I should confess is that these kind of studies take such an investment that we don't have, for almost everything, we don't have a real good cladistic analysis.
Right, so what I'm getting at is that if one had a large enough rodent or a small enough primate that one could study by, endangered species laws or what have you, then that would be a better test of this than the existing body of data. That's what I was...
A good test would be to go to a highly visual rodent, and a highly visual rodent are any of the squirrels. And gray squirrels have a beautifully differentiated, very large primary visual area. So it'd be hard to argue that they don't have enough neurons or it's not big enough to do this. What I think you might argue is that they have fewer neurons than a primate with visual cortex of the same size.
So is this the common type found in university campuses?
Yeah.
Oh, God. This could be totally easily done in so many places in the U.S.
Oh, the squirrel has been done. Squirrel.
It hasn't been. Do they have these?
No. No.
Ah, okay. So
that's the best example. But you could get a bigger rodent if you go to Brazil.
So I get the impression that people think this is an important stepping stone along the route to the best brain of all. Are there any?
I'm not saying the best brain of all.
I'm saying
this is one of many.
So what I'm asking is, are there any behavioral correlates of columnar organization, of orientation correlates? Columns.
That you have a good question, and I would say that squirrels and tree shrews would be good to compare behaviorally and see if they do anything differently. But I'll make the other argument that, you know, if you just watch them and look at their, and they have been in a few experiments of form and so on, and what lesions do to this, they act very similar. So we don't know the answer to that.
Well, of course, I mean, there's a caveat there that it may be, it's all about the spatial arrangements of cells.
Yes.
So the level of network, I mean, the network in squirrel and in cat may look the same, right? But the cells may be scrambled spatially, so there are no columns. So, no? I mean, so there's a caveat that spatial arrangement doesn't actually reflect the network connectivity.
I'll give you a similar situation. People in the auditory system looking at auditory cortex have looked for a spatial map over and over again, and they don't find any. But they do find neurons that are selective to where the sound comes from, but they don't form an orderly map. Squirrels have neurons that are selective to stimulus orientation, and they seem to have just as many as a tree shrew, but they don't form an orderly map. So my point was is that in one phylogenetic line, you see it in all the members that have been studied, and in the other, you don't see. And it's hard to explain. But it's not clear that your visual processing is going to be much different. I'm not sure about that. The question of orderly maps is a real interesting one, but do you need them, or can you have the information distributed? So I have to close because the cookie time is coming. This is an ancestor. So we had an expanded visual system. A posterior parietal region that is a lot like primates. Subdivisions of anterior parietal cortex most more clearly resembled primates. And a motor area and possibly a second motor area with a large representation of the forelimb were already there. So now I just will go through early primates, and we have till 3 o'clock?
3:15.
Okay, I have time. So this is a reconstruction of an early primate 65 to 55 million years ago. And what's interesting is they had a well-developed visual system from the size of the eyes, from the foramen that the optic tract went through. And other anatomical features suggested that they ate largely fruit, but maybe insects as well, and lived in the fine branches of trees, and would be rather agile in holding onto things and reaching out to get food and bringing it to their mouth. And what they probably didn't do with this reduced nose in forward-facing eyes is use their face to get things, because then you would endanger your eyes. So eye-hand coordination is something that would characterize, from the gross anatomy, would characterize early primates. And to study present-day primates, most of them don't resemble at all early primates in terms of basic anatomy. But some of the prosimian primates, this is a galago from Africa, resemble in size and basic anatomy these early primates. And as you can guess from what I've told you so far, if you want to learn most rapidly with these methods that take a tremendous amount of work, you would study prosimian primates, whatever ones you could get, see what their brains are like, and then compare them to the more studied monkeys and other primates and see what they had in common. That's the sort of approach we've taken. And these you can study because they breed well and in captivity, and if you have a colony, you can keep going. And the brain, this, it already has, again, a greatly expanded occipital region, a greatly expanded temporal lobe. Frontal region is rather expanded. So the olfactory portion isn't so big anymore. It's largely hidden. And this is the basic organization of the cortex of this brain. You have a huge primary visual area, secondary visual area, other visual areas all around here. This collection of visual areas that characterize primates, middle temporal visual area, MT, MST, FST, MTC, and so on. These areas forming a ventral stream that gets to the frontal lobe and a dorsal stream of processing that a lot of people have talked about through posterior parietal cortex, the posterior part of it, and then to the anterior part, and then to a collection of motor areas here. And you get all these motor areas that you don't see in other mammals that characterize primates. And you have primary motor cortex, a dorsal premotor area, a ventral premotor area, frontal eye field, a supplementary area, and at least two cingulate motor areas. All this complex is there, and you see this not only in these prosimian primates, but you see all of the areas that I've shown here in every primate that you look at. So there's a big transition from other members of our superorder, that is, tree shrews, lagomorphs, rodents, other mammals in general, to a very complex arrangement of areas. Auditory areas are primate-like in their organization as well. So you have all these things that are shared across all primates, and we could deduce from this that they would be present when primates emerged, and the first primates emerged. Do you want to know the real reason? Anne Grable once said, primate researchers would rather share each other's toothbrushes than their terminology. So this is a terminology that comes from John Allman and I, and you'll hear John Allman talk tomorrow. We're the first to describe the retinotopic organization and define this as an area. We're the first to describe this and so on. But if Samir Zeki was here, he'd say, well, I was the first to describe this, and I was the first, and I named them. So what scientists seem to have done is they're, you know, let's use B4 for one area and MT for another area, and then both groups get credit. So that's what seems to be what's done. So you can call it B4. I'll be fine with that. But I won't use your toothbrush.
Thank God.
And what's interesting, and there's an investigator, Graziano, Mike Graziano at Princeton, who has said we should, when we electrically stimulate motor areas of cortex and you can get a movement, you can get a map of movements and you can get a sense of organization. And this has been used to help determine how many motor areas there are, because if you get four or five different maps of motor movements, you can say there are four or five different motor areas. But he said, let's stimulate with a train of stimuli and get a complex movement, because if you do this in motor cortex of a macaque monkey that's awake, you can get a complex movement. And he said a complex movement is something that takes about a second, half a second to emerge, so let's stimulate for a half a second. And we tried this procedure, and we got complex movements. And we got these not only in monkeys, but we got them in prosimian galagos. And this is the region here in posterior parietal cortex, the anterior half of posterior parietal cortex. And we got complex movements. And so we got face defensive movements here, eye movements here, face aggressive movements here, forelimb and face aggressive movements here, hand-to-mouth retrieving here, forelimb reaching out in a defensive, forelimb over here reaching out in a reach movement over here, hind limb and forelimb together as if climbing over here. So in general, you have a pattern from hind limb to face or hind limb to eye. But within this, you have islands, large regions of cortex that seem to be devoted to movements that have ecological significance for the animal.
So you do that in anesthetized?
It's anesthetized. Graziano did it in awake animals, but by anesthetizing the animals, we can simulate so many more sites because we can expose a huge amount of brain and look at a lot of different sites. And it's amazing to me that it happens. So it doesn't depend on consciousness. It's not that the animal is willing to do something. It's we believe that we're activating a circuit, not just this cortex, but a circuit that's specific and changes. The circuit that you're accessing here is different than the one here, or the different than the one here. They have elements in common, but they're different. And it turns out that, I'll show you those movements, it turns out that visual inputs come in here, they relay up here. Somatosensory go into this region, so you're mixing somatosensory, and all of this goes forward to the motor areas. And if you use a drug to knock out the activity of the motor areas, primary motor cortex, these movements disappear. You can't stimulate posterior parietal cortex and get these behaviors anymore. They depend on going through the motor areas.
Could you say a few words about how precisely you do these stimulation in which you go through an area?
Yeah, so I'm going to show you some of the movements, but basically if you put an electrode in here and put it down to about layer 5 and stimulate with a train of electrical pulses for half a second, you will see a movement that we would classify as a defensive movement of the face. If you go over here, you'll see a movement of retrieving the hand to the mouth.
This is the duration of the stimulus.
And the movement takes most of a half a second. It starts a little bit after the stimulus, and it may continue a little past the stimulus if the movement isn't continued.
So, well, what spacing are the movements of your stimulus? Like, do you advance 100 microns or 200
microns? So the electrodes might be 100 microns apart, or maybe 200 microns apart. And we do this really densely. And every time you move the electrode, you get a different variation of that movement. And then you get a transition to a different kind of movement. So within the face, this is a good example. Face aggressive here, but as you go medially, you start to involve the forelimb. So I wouldn't say that's a sharp border.
The anomaly here is that this used, if I understand this correctly, this is like Graziano's stuff, and that this is what people would have called M1. Right, so where Penfield would like say, you know, tickle and just get fat. Right.
Those are single shots, right. This is why I was asking.
But this is in posterior parietal cortex, not in motor cortex.
Oh, it's in posterior parietal cortex.
But it depends on motor cortex.
It was all in M1, in so-called M1, wasn't it?
It's all in M1 or the premotor areas, except he just has done one study in posterior parietal cortex in just one of these areas, and he got defensive movements.
Okay.
But the point here, I think, that's more interesting is that we're using visual information, auditory information, somatosensory information, all converging here, and these are the areas where the initial planning is critical. And this, each one of these regions has a different pattern of connections to the motor and premotor areas. But if you knock out the premotor or motor areas, you abolish this behavior completely. So it's dependent on going through those circuits. So what we think is this is an early kind of organization that would characterize all primates, but is already organized in a somewhat different manner in macaque monkeys. It's more like this in New World monkeys, but in macaque monkeys, you get a rotation and more complexity to this arrangement in posterior parietal cortex and an expansion of posterior parietal cortex. This all needs to be worked out because this method hasn't been applied in detail except to one part of it, small part of it, in macaque monkeys yet.
Thinking about posterior parietal, like in terms of sort of spatial coordinate systems and so forth, would you identify a lot of these behaviors as being focused around a particular location? I can imagine like face defense, being defensive about a particular part of the body. That kind of
so, thing. Here would be what we would classify as aggressive behavior. It involves pulling the ears back and usually squinting. Which these would be protective components maybe, but baring the teeth. And a defensive movement would be bringing the hand up to ward off a blow. That's an important part, but also folding ears back to protect them from being damaged. Hand to mouth is just simple, pulling something towards the mouth. Reaching is to reach out towards something. So all of these are videotaped and scored, and we can do this in a quantitative manner, and you get the same behavior at the same site, you know, over and over again. And every time you move the electrode, you get a slightly different version
of a paid class
until you merge into another class. So we think this is sort of an early primate scheme for organizing these kind of behaviors and how they relate to motor areas of cortex. And we're working on trying to see how this has been modified and changed in especially old world monkeys, where it seems to be somewhat different than this. And I just point out, and then because it's time to stop, is that primary visual cortex has the famous cytochrome oxidase blobs in all primates. V2 has the banding pattern. If you don't know what this is, it's just features that are shared by all primates, including Galagos. It has weak bands, but it has bands in it. It has these other visual areas, such as it has this MT complex, MST complex, and you can see this in flattened cortex. You can see it's there. Cytochrome oxidase, high level of activity. MST, high level of activity compared to the surrounding cortex. So you can identify these features once you do it physiologically or by connection patterns with histology as well. And is this just my former student who's now at Irvine demonstrating that there are three steps that are clear in processing visual information, and the V1, V2, and V3. And part of this is because there is controversy of whether there is a V3 or not. Part of the controversy, John Ullman and I argued that there wasn't. You can ask tomorrow about this. But here's an injection site. You can see the label here. You can see the label here. So there, these. So this is, information is relayed here. So it's really visual information here that we have, visual evidence that those areas exist. Here's the label in MT. You can see how much sparser it is. Hardly can see it. And here's an area that we call DM. There's also some label up in there. You can't see it unless you go to the microscope. So that's where the main projections are, those three areas. This would be V6 or something like that in Secchi's terminology. Here's primates. All are different from all non-primates in the way they represent space in the superior colliculus. I won't go into it, but all of the primates form this pattern. All other mammals that have been looked at form this other pattern. So that's another innovation in the primates.
At least tell us what it is.
Okay, I have to figure out where I go back, but there I am. Okay. So the primitive pattern is you represent the complete contralateral eye in the superior colliculus and part of the ipsilateral eye. That's the primitive pattern. All mammals seem to do that. And the amount of ipsilateral is variable. But the complete contralateral is there. So this would be the complete contralateral retina. It forms this whole pattern. But if you want to superimpose images, this is what you want. If you want to superimpose images. So primates have just taken that part that you superimpose for binocular vision and used the whole superior colliculus for that. And no other mammal seems to have done that.
So in some sense, it's a feature that's lost.
It's a feature that's lost. So this kind of organization is what you see in cortex. But so you have this strange thing of having a different kind of map in cortex than you do in the optic tectum or superior colliculus. But primates, they're congruent. You have the same kind of map here as you do in primary visual cortex. And it has to do with, I think, the emphasis on binocular vision and frontal vision. So here's a bunch of conclusions that I've already gone over, so I won't go over them again. And this is just a number of shared features. There are a whole lot of shared features across primates. And then there are some, and here's some more. However, there are aspects of the somatosensory system, and I won't drag on to this, that are different in prosimian primates than anthropoid primates. And anthropoid primates are monkeys, apes, and humans. So prosimians do more parallel processing from the thalamus, the cortex, and the somatosensory system. And anthropoid primates do more serial processing. So areas of cortex, the secondary areas here that are activated in parallel with the primary areas in prosimian primates and all other mammals that have been studied are activated serially from the primary area in anthropoid primates. So this is the difference that has happened in the processing. There are advantages to the serial, there are advantages to the parallel. Parallel is going to be faster, serial is going to be more elegant. You can think of it that way. And why you would change from one to the other, but anthropoids advance by losing something. And then this is the range of brains. This is the smallest one. Human is the largest. Suzanne is going to talk about that. A lot of the change has been over the last 2 million years. You can get that just from the skull shapes. And it raises a scaling problem. And I'm not going to talk about scaling problems, but I just want to raise it because I'll say something and then we'll be done. I had a course in graduate school from Knut Schmidt-Nielsen, who's one of the great biologists of all times. They have a statue on Duke campus of him on campus. Where else do they take a faculty member in the biology department and make a statue of him while he's living and put it on campus? They usually put the person that gave the most money to the university. So they did that. He wrote a whole book about scaling problems in the body, and he didn't talk about the brain at all. And because the brain is too hard, was thought to be too hard to deal with, and he had to be too expert to do this. And this is just an example, of course, of Salvador Dali and one of his great paintings. And what intrigues us about this is that this is impossible. You can't have these little spider legs. It'll work well for a spider, but it can't work for these elephants trudging along. You can't engineer it that way. So as things get bigger, you have to change them in many ways. And this is only one way. I won't even talk about this because we don't have time. And then Susan is going to talk about brains of the same size or approximately the same size that if you're a primate, you're lucky you have more neurons. And you can even speculate about rodents long gone because they're extinct now and how many neurons, by using the scaling rules, how many neurons they had. And even the biggest rodent wouldn't come close to a human in number of neurons.
But they recently found a big rodent, which is
even bigger than that one?
1 pound in weight.
Okay, maybe. Maybe then. That was that was a little over half a ton.
Well, yeah. I thought it was a big
rodent. Yeah, it was a giant rodent. It was huge. Rodent.
Okay, I really am done.
Genetic instruction code proposed to underlie the regionalization of all the brain areas, proposed in the 90s by Rubenstein and Coates, maybe 14 years ago.
Yes.
I was curious to see whether you know what that underlies the regionalization of areas in the species that you studied.
It's one of the most important things of how the areas come to be and how you end up getting more. Present speculation is that maybe human brains has something in the order of 250 areas, so it's a huge number. It seems that there's a lot of evidence that these primary areas that you see in all mammals are special, specified, and that you can move them around through genetic manipulations. You can duplicate at least the somatosensory one through genetic manipulations and so on. So. But it's not clear how you get from a few areas to a lot of areas, and if you do that in the same way or you do it in a different way. And some people think that you do it in a different way by just having a few key areas, and these few key areas form a sort of a template for adding on and differentiating adjoining areas that they have connections with, and this sort of cascades through the system. I don't know. It's not really known. There are people that would argue strongly either way. Anybody want to comment? Yeah.
So is there any similarity, like in making the structure more complex in evolution and development, like the functional part?
Yes, because somebody just came and talked at Vanderbilt, and they said, as George would say, knowing the development of the brain is very important, or knowing the development of a behavior or anything like that is very important. And I think it's equally important to understand the evolution, and they go hand in hand and to a large extent, because the evolution of brains, they become different through altering the course of development. So it's largely changing the developmental course, and so you can say I'm studying brain evolution through studying brain development and getting insights of when things can change and how they change. And so there's been a lot of interest in people that are studying evolution in brain development.
Well, the thing that gets selected for is function, for fitness, but the mechanisms that get selected aren't
the
ones. Right. So blind people use their V1 primarily for word memory.
Yes.
Which is supporting the hypothesis that cortex is wonder tissue and it's fairly plastic.
Well, one of the amazing...
So the question is, does anybody cross-correlate these anatomical studies with transitions in hypothesized transitions in the ecology of the creatures? So, for example, if you have aggression and defensive areas emerging in the cortex, could that correspond with a transition in the amount of competition between the creatures at that period in time?
Well,
things are emerging from ecological challenges rather than genetic.
One would be important to do, and because these studies are just emerging, is to go and study more intensively the behavior in the animals that you're studying and see how much it matches or compares with behaviors that occur in the normal behavior. Graziano has done that with macaque monkeys in terms of positions of hands and so on, just observed hundreds and hundreds. Where is the hand put? What things are done? How does that correlate with the sort of things you get when you're stimulating? So there are beginnings of this. To take it one step further and argue what does this behavior do for the animal and when would it emerge in evolution and why did it emerge then? That would be one of the long-term goals and something really worth achieving, but as you can see, it might be rather difficult.
Difficult, yeah. It's difficult to tease out genetic evolution from ecological drift.
Yeah.
In general, I would imagine.
Cookies?
Thank you, John.
Thank you.